This is KZSU, Stanford. For all you knights of entitled opinions and all you souls in astral and all you venerable trustees of this radio program, welcome back to our Feast of Friends on 90.1 FM, where our revels have not yet ended and we keep the beat going for the Great Brigade. In his poem, Cold Spring Morning, the American poet W.S. Merwin wrote, "The self has no age." A few verses later, he declares, "The sky has no sky except itself this white morning in May." I don't know about the sky, I don't know about the self, yet the sky I see today is not the same as it was in time past. When I was 7, it was my body's covenant with the cosmos. By 20, it was a veil between me and the future. By 40, it had become the face of an abstraction. Today, it's the dome of a house I know I won't inhabit for too much longer. Shortly, it will be the answer to what today still remains a question. If the self has a sky, then it also has a celestial age. So let me offer up to the brigade a sentence that you may want to remember on your future birthdays. Nothing in the universe, be it the newborn infant or the universe itself, is without age. If a phenomenon does not age, it is not of this world. And if it is not of this world, it is not a phenomenon. The topic of our show today is aging. We have some unusual ideas about aging in America. We tend to think of it as a curse, a loss, an impoverishment, an expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Yet how thoughtless is that? Aging is the metabolism of life, an unfolding into your essence and who you already are. Throughout human history, the young have always emulated adults precisely because they yearn for that fullness of being. Nowadays, it's the other way around. The elderly aspire to be young. Again, how absurd is that? The major privileges and benefits of society belong to later stages of life. That's as true today as it was in the past. Most of the adults who today anxiously hang on to the trappings of youth would never choose to return to the travails of childhood or adolescence. They're too well off for that. The irony is that we live in a youth-obsessed society that is fundamentally gerontocratic in nature. To put it in propositional form, youth is a deceptive and self-consuming ideal. Our trusty Epicurus put it best, I quote, "It is not the young who should be considered fortunate, but the old person who has lived well," end quote. It takes emotional and intellectual maturity to realize that we stay young in later life not by abhorring the aging process, but by cultivating our minds. The mind, which never finishes learning, has a special capacity to stay fully awake even as the darkness falls, and to remain grateful for what life has offered up in the past. Epicurus again, quote, "Both when young and old, one should devote oneself to philosophy, in order that, while growing old, he shall be young in blessings through gratitude for what has been. The life of the fool is marked by ingratitude and apprehension. The drift of his thought is exclusively toward the future. Forgetting the good that has been, he becomes an old man this very day." Speaking of gratitude and living well, let me quote someone else here, someone who went to his death gratefully a few weeks ago at the age of 78. In a March 2025 interview with Rolling Stone, Bob Weir declared, "Every day things change. I'll say this, I look forward to dying. I tend to think of death as the last and best reward for a life well lived." As a founding member of the Grateful Dead, Bob Weir turned his band's name into a philosophy of life. Comrade Epicurus didn't believe in an afterlife. Yet, if he was wrong and is out there somewhere, he'll be the first to welcome Bobby Weir into the astral realm. The guest who joins me in the studio today is writing a book about aging and will be sharing with us some of her own thoughts on that topic. Adrienne Korn earned a PhD from Vanderbilt University in leadership, policy, and organizational behavior. She is the founder of Human Talented, a software and services company located in Nashville, Tennessee. And she's also a longtime listener of Entitled Opinion. So, Adrienne, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Harrison. It's a pleasure to be here.
I mentioned that you're writing a book about aging, and I'm curious, first off, what inspired you to embark on this topic?
Oh, it's a great question. To be honest, writing a book on aging wasn't something that I had aspired to do, but I've come to, over the past few years, as I've moved toward the end of my middle age, so I'm no longer young, but I'm not yet old. It's not so much about the number as it is the physical reality of getting older that has been dawning on me. I think it's pretty universal that we come to the awareness of old age first with our bodies. But it's also something I'm observing in the larger culture as well. As the elderly, which are people over the age of 60, are the fastest growing population segment in the Western world. I'm naturally curious about what this journey of aging will be, where it will lead, but find so much of what the culture tells us about aging is that it's a negative experience and one to be avoided by remaining young in every way possible, or outsmarted through science and technology. But what if we embraced it early on? So I wanted to explore aging from the perspective of curiosity and learning, intentionally thinking about it now as a place, a space where I will eventually end up, because it's where all of us eventually end up. I'm trained as a quantitative social scientist, so my work across my career has been focused on both individual identity and its interplay collectively with the larger cultural context. And one of those variables that's part of our identity is values. So for me, that's shorthand for what matters to us. And in writing this book, I wanted to explore the ways in which research, philosophy, and pragmatism intersect to help us think about what matters to us in the context of aging. How can they inform this journey into old age from its very beginning, even before we get there? What can we learn and what can we begin to practice?
So can you say a little bit more about your background as a social scientist and what use you're going to make of that training as you attack this topic?
Sure. My early work focused on identity, education, and occupational choice. So in other words, who we are and how we learn to be what we are, and then how we fit into the working world and persist within those contexts of the work given who we are. After I finished my PhD, I started a company called Human Talented, and I focus on research and consulting around aligning who we are, our identities, with occupation, so what people do in their work lives. The goal for me in starting the company was to solve the problem plaguing 80% of people who feel unfulfilled by the work that they do each day. The lack of meaningful work really has a negative effect, a deleterious effect on our lives, and we spend about a third of our time at work. So the goal was really to build tools and a practice to help individuals understand their identity variables and then match those variables with occupations and companies so that they could align with their identities. And that goal would be to help them live more meaningful lives overall. So just a quick summary of that would be, Harrison, to say that my interests as a social scientist have been double-sided. I'm interested in the individual, which would be the micro piece of it, but I'm also interested in the collective, which is the macro side of this as well. And aging for me is very double-sided. It has both micro and macro ramifications.
Do you agree with my statement that we live in a youth-obsessed society that is fundamentally gerontocratic in nature?
I absolutely agree with you. I think that this is one of the big reasons why pursuing this book was important to me, because all around me at the cultural level, at the macro level, what we're seeing is this gear towards being young, towards not letting go of our youth over time, even as our bodies are letting go of youth over time. And it's important for us to embrace that move towards being older and what we experience as being older, as opposed to keeping this place in our youth and refusing to move out of it. One of my favorite books on culture and age is, of course, your book on juvenescence, because it tackles the complexity and the question of aging and how that works.
Where age is not just biological, a number of years, but it's also what age do you belong to? Cultural age, historical age, no? What does it mean to be 40 years of age in the 21st century as opposed to, you know, the 3rd century BC and so forth? So there's no doubt that our aging, our experience of age is influenced by the, let's say the micro, what you call the micro, is influenced by the macro context in which we're actually performing our age. So you said that the aging population is becoming a very substantial minority. I mean, it's not a majority yet in America, right? But it's a very, very substantial minority.
Yes, that's correct. It's becoming a majority in Western populations.
It is becoming a majority.
Yes.
That means over 60, right? Is that what the elder, is that how you define the
Yeah,
elderly?
Actually, the Older American Act, Older Americans Act of 1965 defines older adulthood as adults over 60.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you foresee, as a social scientist, do you foresee a lot of problems, social problems, given the demographics?
It's definitely something that is affecting us from a policy perspective in terms of the healthcare issues that we're facing, obviously. So one of the major areas for the elderly is Alzheimer's and dementia. In that particular area alone, we've seen that 1 in 8 Americans over the age of 65 will have some level of Alzheimer's or dementia. And the resources aren't available to address those from a policy perspective. So absolutely, we're seeing that there are resources that are going to need to be in play that aren't currently.
So one of my assumptions is that aging to the advanced age is actually a luxury.
Mm.
And that it's absurd to lament the fact that you turn 80, for example, when you could be dead. And would you, you know, what would you prefer? And if you're going to insist on living as long as you can, then you have to be ready for the decrepitudes that come into that process, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, you can look at the looming problem of the majority of geriatric people as something to be alarmed at, but you could also see it as, you know, as a sign of the greatest success, socially speaking, that that many people, quite exceptionally, according to the laws of nature, have reached an age when in ages past they would most likely be dead, right?
Agreed. I agree with you. Aging is not the problem. To say that aging is the problem would be to say that being a human is the problem, right? Since we begin aging from the beginning. I think definitely the problem is aging in a culture that's obsessed with remaining young. If I were to quote you on your show, in your book, Juvenescence, you say that we do not promote the cause of youth when we infantilize rather than educate desire and then capitalize on its bad infinity. And I want to turn that around and I want to say that that's true of aging as well. We do not promote the cause of aging when we infantilize rather than educate desire and then capitalize on its bad infinity. So I think that there is something to be celebrated by and through the process of aging. If we get to 80, absolutely, it's a celebration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's double-sided. I think in Western society, the idea that we age and can still be part of society is great. You know, we see this in lots of places, but the infantilization of aging is the problem. And I think preventing the natural maturation process, that's the one that I would really take issue with, I think.
Right. So a lot of this sociologically is approached, you know, as these problems, medical problems, Alzheimer's problems, there's the elderly in more need of care, there's social security, there's the way in which the elderly are always screwing over the young one way or another. It's the young who pay the price for the luxury of excessively prolonged aging. And we can deal with it technically or medically and even psychologically, but what Epicurus and others like Seneca and these, there's a great tradition of senescence as something to be celebrated. And I think that you are actually flowing into that discourse in some ways when you say that we should be celebrating rather than lamenting, but that cultivating certain virtues like gratitude for the has-been, I think seems to me a very obvious, a self-evident proposition the older one gets, because the older you get, the more past you have accumulated and the more you can start building up the capital of gratitude. If you're Epicurean enough, you're building up a solid foundation for the kind of happiness that might pertain to a later stage of life. There's different ways of being happy, obviously, and I think that when you talk about celebrating, I think you're also, if I hear you correctly, trying to conceive of how to reconfigure the notion of happiness in those years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think bringing in the stories and the connection to history as well. So I think how to be happy is a big question. That's a big elephant to try to eat. So when we think about how to do that in old age, when we currently don't even have really good models of how to move into old age and transfer and transition into old age, that elephant becomes even bigger.
Sure. So where do you start? You're saying you have to start with something more basic.
Right. So I've been reading Sharon Blackie, is a PhD in England. And if I quote her, she says, quote, "The ways in which we think about aging depends on the stories we tell about it. How we think about aging women depends on the images we hold of them. And the images we hold of aging women today aren't healthy. The truth is there is no clear image of enviable female elderhood in the contemporary cultural mythology of the West. It's not an archetype we recognize anymore. In our culture, old women are mostly ignored, encouraged to be inconspicuous, or held up as objects of derision and satire," unquote. And the reason I bring this up, even though we're talking about happiness, is because I think the idea of happiness is a great one. This is something we absolutely should aspire to in our later years. But we don't have a lot of stories in our current lexicon of how to be happy in those years, because this obsession with youth has a sibling, which is fear of aging.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't be happy if you're living with this fear of aging.
Right. So in our contemporary society, we don't have a notion of the elderly woman as having the proper dignity and even privilege, whereas in other times and in other cultures, there is. If I'm thinking of the book that you're referring to, which I haven't read myself, but you've been telling me about it, that there are models out there that can be retrieved from different cultures.
In fact, I should just name the book. Sharon Blackie's book is named Haggitude, and it is
Haggitude with an H, right?
Haggitude with an H, yes. And I think it's a great resource, much like another book that you have introduced me to, which is called Winter Light by
Douglas Pennick. Winter Light, extraordinary book, yeah.
Yeah, and I think these kinds of models that talk about how we can transition into old age through the models that are laid out before us in previous cultures, they tie us not only to this idea of transition into old age, but into our own past, our own history, right? And it goes back, I think, to this idea of the heterochronicity that you're talking about, right? We are as old as the universe, right? We are as young as today. But this is this idea that we are also tied to the history if we can know it and internalize it, those stories of people who have done this successfully or have done it and have passed those stories on to us.
Right.
I think also there's another piece of getting older that we often don't talk about. It's this idea of agency. There's so much of getting old that when you talk about being happy, to some extent, we in American culture associate happiness with our own agency, our own sense of we can make ourselves happy. But I think the idea that age is agentic is a bit of a problem because we only have so much control.
Yes, I may have not used the best word when I said happiness. It could be a different word. Like there's a certain – I'm getting this from in large part also from Douglas Pennock's book, Winter Light. And he's speaking from the point of view of someone who has turned 79. And he speaks about the perceptual shift that there's so much that one loses in the aging process. Mm-hmm. And you become increasingly worldless and sidelined and irrelevant. But a weird thing happens when you realize that how precious time is that you have a perceptual shift and the world reveals itself to you without your agency being involved. It's almost like this passive inspiration of being open to the revelations of, you know, presence and shades of meaning. And also, I think he quotes someone whose father is sitting on a lawn and what's he say? He says, "I never knew there were so many kinds of green," says this 96-year-old man in the backyard. There are certain perceptions which are crowded out when you are in the prime of life, full of agency and action and, you know, projects and all those things which youth, future orientation and so forth. And so let's not call it happiness, but let's call it a certain intensity that comes from a heightened awareness of the evanescence of time and the world. And going back to the question of women, I know a lot of young women who are really seeking out the wisdom of older women who have been through stages of life and this looking forward, but that we don't have a society in which that kind of mentorship of the elderly, of the younger, that kind of intergenerational continuity. And I'm wondering if when you talk about the gender difference in the experience of aging, whether that mentorship role of an elderly woman is something that you have in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are two ways I want to talk about that. The first way is related to the work that I would do. I really saw this gender gap when I started working with senior executives. So I would see men who were moving into retirement versus women who were moving into retirement. And the men who were moving into retirement were having really a difficult time with it. And the reason for that was because they had often tied their identities to their careers. So who they were was very much just defined by what they did for a living and how they earned what mattered to them, from money to prestige to recognition. There is a quote in a TV program I watched recently that said, "Without an economic function, society buries you before you're dead," which is a terrible, terrible way to think about the world, I think.
But, hasn't buried me.
Jeez, it's terrible. But so many men can relate to that statement. So many men that I've worked with. Women, on the other hand, tend to define themselves and their identities in relationship to relevance in their communities. So who they are is defined in part by where they belong, which often is much broader than a single community of work. So because those communities change across their lifespans, this is where they learn as opposed to earn what matters to them, from money to prestige or recognition. So their transition into retirement seems very different than men's. in this aging population that we've been talking about, the majority of the aging population, the adults over 60, are actually women. And to go back to what you were saying, that so many young women are seeking those role models, I think that's absolutely true. I think having those stories and a connection to another generation is really important. You talk about in Juvenescence that, and this is a quote from you, the past doesn't cease to exist simply because we lose our memory of it. And I think connecting our memory across generations is a really important piece that we can begin to internalize and practice.
But we need to practice it not just in our own selves, isolated selves. We need the generational presence of multi-generational communities where, because we do live in an age of generational segregation. The children, school, adults in the workplace, the elderly in retirement homes or wherever, no?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is historically very exceptional where you had those generations all within the same household and where you had this very continuous sort of communication and transmission of practices, memories, the notion of educating the young in ways that were not based on curriculum, not based on schoolwork, but just initiation, the initiation process.
If we think
grandmothers are so essential for, I mean, I know young women who are so fond of their grandmothers and are just devastated when the grandmother dies in a way that may perhaps even more than a parent. Who knows? I mean, I don't want to make any sweeping statements, but that need of the young is for the elderly presence is as great, if not greater, than the need of the elderly to have the young to mentor. No?
I have a friend in Chicago who builds intergenerational housing, and she does this with the intention of exactly what you're speaking about, giving people a place where this transmission can occur,
right,
so that there is this transmission of not just learning in a way that we can pass a test or that we understand with our minds, but that gets transmitted in the nonverbal. If we think about most of our communication actually being nonverbal, then this transmission of wisdom, of knowledge, doesn't just happen with our words. It happens in our actions. It happens in how we live in the daily. We begin to observe people who are elderly, observe how they live their lives. What does a day look like for an 80-year-old, right? What does it look like for my grandmother to wake up in the morning, to eat lunch, to go to bed at night? How does she live those days? What do her steps look like? And we begin to understand what it can be to be an old person with dignity, right?
Right.
That gets transmitted to us and through that experience of living together. And I think it's a beautiful concept that is being practiced, right, by building this kind of housing.
Yeah. And I think you're right that it somehow seems to be easier to take place in context of women rather than men. There's a little bit too much Oedipal tension in the father-son relations. But who knows? I mean, the grandfather also has a certain dignity and a certain charisma as well as – I mean, I don't want to divide it too much by gender, but I like your idea that when they get older, women tend to create – or their values tend to go in the direction of community as opposed to production. Anyway, do you want to share some more thoughts on what you have in mind when you think of how – people around your age should prepare? I don't know if it's not to prepare for later stages of life, but I gather that one of the ambitions of your book is to propose some kind of agenda for, if only, awareness and bring a certain kind of heightened awareness of the fact that we're all within this stream of aging, no?
I think cross-contextual learning that we were talking about matters. I don't think it matters just for women. So I do maybe disagree with you that, you know, men wouldn't also benefit from that. I think we do. I think we all benefit from this intergenerational learning. I think women have an easier time of it, just to answer that. But I don't think that men, I don't think they fall away from it. I think they will also embrace it as well. But it's something that we don't have as something that's in our culture right now.
No, I agree. I what I meant is not for the older men. I think my sense is that there's less receptivity among the younger males than there are among younger women.
Yeah, and to that point, I think, you know, we teach the young how to live when we're grown, right? We educate them on eating, speaking, dressing, thinking, working. And in doing so, we perpetuate the process, right? So the idea is it possible to offer a pathway toward aging that can teach the middle-aged, even the younger, how to live when we're old, right? What does that look like? And I think that there are ways to educate that process. You had said, and again, I know I keep going back to juvenescence, you had talked about education being the most vital vocation because it teaches the young how to see in the dark. And I love that because this is exactly what we're talking about. We're in the dark when it comes to aging. And so education is an absolute part of, I think, this process going forward. So what can philosophy offer us in terms of a path forward? What can we learn from the philosophers that can help rejuvenate this idea of intergenerational aging, the models for aging? What can we learn from social science that can help us realign what I believe is a misalignment currently, right? If the misalignment is that we are aging and aging is a problem, then how do we realign with aging as a natural part of the process and we should do that and learn what we can from that process? I'm looking at aging from various different domains. So from the physical domain, what is it that we value in the physical? And how could we then learn and practice what we value in the aging context about the physical? So if there's a loss of physical ability as we age biologically, rather than fear or deny that loss, what is it that we value that we could bring into that new mindset as we age? So gratitude. You mentioned Epicurus, of course. I think if we have gratitude for what remains in our bodies, maybe there's a philosophy. Yoga has, for example, philosophy, the practice of prana, mindful movement, or pranayama, which is the awareness of breath. In the pragmatic sense, perhaps it's planning. If we value being alive and the denial of the inevitable is misaligned, and we know that Alzheimer's is on the horizon, perhaps we find a way to plan checks at the micro level and then collectively on the policy level, we fund for those resources at that's the macro level. So I think that there are ways to do that in the physical realm. In the mental realm, again, we figure out, I think, what we value in this area of aging, and then we build in ways to approach it. And again, from the perspective of, I'm not yet old. I would like to understand, what can I begin to see? What can I begin to practice at the micro individual level? And then how can I begin to build community and understanding at the more cultural, collective community level?
Well, I should say that when I was young, in high school, college, graduate school, my primary ambition was to become as old as I possibly could, namely, not hundreds of years, but thousands of years old. Mm. By entering into the minds of Homer, or it could be the scripture, the pre-Socratic philosophers. So I think that by the time I was 25, you asked me, I would have said, how old am I? Yeah, I'm 2,500 years old. So what I'd like to suggest, and this is, of course, for someone who spends a lot of time reading, doing philosophy and things of that sort, is that in addition to cultivating gratitude and the other kind of more practical measures that you've mentioned, that one can enlarge one's community through reading and holding converse with authors who can go back, you know, hundreds, thousands of years. And that reading is a way of enhancing one's age, becoming culturally older than one is, to become an heir of long traditions rather than nowadays where everyone seems to want to be an orphan of, you know, history. I think that people who are readers in their older age, my impression, of course, I'm not a social scientist. I've never been able to marshal any statistics for any of my claims, and I never will, I guess. But my strong impression is that people who are readers have blessings that those who don't read don't have, that they have the luxury of inhabiting multiple worlds. Because every time you enter a book, you're entering into a world of sorts. And it's not the same thing as watching a television program or a movie or a television series. There's something about a partnership with the authors that one's reading. So that I think there's a community of the dead that we can also bring into the very consciousness that you were referring to earlier.
Yeah, to your point, you said this, that we live in data overwhelm. I don't think those were your exact words, but this idea that we no longer read, we Google. We're online, we're on our phones, and there's a short period of attention that we have. And so we're not truly delving into the history of those stories of people who are thousands of years old, who have things to teach us. And that idea that we could cross this chasm between knowing and being through education, through reading, it's absolutely one of the practices I think is important as we age and something that we can begin to build into our process of understanding. So the mental process, right, of aging. I think another domain for me is the emotional and then obviously the social. So those are the domains that I can see that we really can begin to look at as areas of understanding what matters to us and then beginning to build a practice around them. Education being fundamental in each of those categories, obviously.
And do you mean education in a formal sense or any kind of learning?
That's a great distinction. I would say informal learning. Obviously, there are things that you can do within any community to learn about various areas of aging. But I think informal learning is so critical to the continued development of our brains, the continued development of our internal lives as we age. And I think the idea that we begin to slow down, we begin to think differently about our time, gives us an opportunity to then engage with those texts and those stories that help us validate what we're doing in our old age.
Yeah. There's a Pennock quote that you brought attention to. I'm going to read it. Most studies into perception in the old focus on losses, deficits, and deviations from norms. There is less investigation of qualitative perceptual shifts. And I would submit that maybe we should include under the rubric of perception also this kind of learning and education and reading practices. It's not just sense perception, it's mental perception, emotional perception. And I think Pennock would definitely agree with me on that front. And of course, again, it's hard to educate in a formal way, so I like your idea that it has to kind of be informal education. But when I try to think of, well, what would I recommend to someone when it comes to this thing, I said, well, go read Winter Light and the radiance of on Late Life's Radiance, great subtitle, no? That informal education often takes the form of reading a book from start to finish. Because as you say, the fact that you just Google something or that you're living in this atomized present, which doesn't have a past and part of the future, that the experience of reading a Moby Dick, for example, which can take you, if not days, weeks, and even months, now all of a sudden you have an experience of time that at the micro level stands for the experience of living an entire life from childhood into late life. You start educating yourself on what forms of continuity might look like. and how you maintain a narrative thread, you know, from beginning, middle, and to the end, as opposed to the insane fragmentation of time in which we all are kind of doomed to live in.
Mm. Pennick also says, he was talking about nostalgia, and he said that no memory is a refuge. And I thought that was
no memory is a refuge. What
no
does he
memory
mean?
Is
what do
a
you
refuge.
Think he means by that?
I think this idea that every memory that we have reminds us of our youth, reminds us of the past. Right. So we are constantly beholden to our past selves, as opposed to being able to move forward. And I think that is, again, it's a bittersweet thought, right?
It definitely is, because if you – I'm going to read a passage from Pennick's book, which is – it's sad but true. But at the same time, it's because it's sad that there's this new openness to the present. He says that none of us ever really imagines that as we become old, the flow of innumerable small changes in our environment will make us feel ever more foreign. Nearby buildings, even undistinguished and unmemorable ones, are suddenly replaced by yet more anonymous commercial office buildings, apartment houses. Neighborhoods vanish without a trace. It soon becomes impossible to remember what was there before, and the new landscape does not even have casual associations. It has no relationship to anything remembered. The unfamiliar streets do not support our continuity. I don't remember what used to be here or how it felt to walk here. This is denatured landscape in which I cannot help but feel less embodied, ghostly. And the tragedy, it's not in the aging, it's also what the world is doing to unworld itself by shattering the context of permanence that used to be always taken for granted, that one's temporary sojourn on this earth had this larger context of permanence. But when the context or the setting itself is undergoing all these convulsions, and that, you know, what was there yesterday is no longer here today, and that what the future, then you have a sense that the interrupted, the rupture in any sort of continuum, which is reflected in the way that we have the Google moment and then we pass on to something else. We don't read, let alone read a long book like Moby Dick. I think nowadays in high schools, they're not even assigning any books in their entirety. I was reading recently that you don't have to read a book from start to finish at all. So everything seems to conspire to unworld the world, and human beings need the stability of worldhood in order to found these identities that we're talking about.
I love your idea of the world. You talk about amor mundi and juvenescence, and I think this is exactly the reason we need a new, let me use the word canon, a new map of a new world, right? It's because when we learn to fear the aging process, or aging becomes only known as loss or pain, exile or death, it is literally the loss of the world as we experience and know it. We're left without a world. What's there to look forward to? Yeah. You know, where do we exist? And I think we need something new. We must have a different perspective. And to get that from various texts, various ways of informal learning, to get that from people who are living in that age of elderness already, right? That's where I think we begin to build a new world for ourselves and our understanding at the micro level. If we begin to do some of these practices at the micro level and to build worlds for ourselves, then can we begin to practice that at the macro level, at the collective cultural level, where we begin to imagine a new world for older people? I don't think we're going to change buildings being knocked down and recreated.
Well, you know, I have to say that I gave a lecture this past summer where I said only a landscape architect can save us. And I believe that part of the building of the new world has to take place not just in the realm of education. It has to take place in the environment as well.
Agreed.
And there are certain kind of visionary landscape architects. A friend of mine, Thomas Waltz, who's also been a guest on Entitled Opinions, what some of these landscape architects are doing is they're restoring that context of permanence that an indiscriminate building has built over. So I think it has to be on very many different fronts that the rebuilding of worlds takes place. It's psychological for sure. It's educational, also in terms of medical and all those other issues. But I think a rehabilitation of the landscape and of the environment is a crucial part of it.
There's some great research on imagination in aging. There was a great study that was done and published in the journal Nature that talked about what we can learn from imagined experiences, and that our brain takes imagination and takes the imagined experience and does with it often what happens to us in actual experiences. It sees them in similar ways. So it suggests that imagination isn't passive, and it can actually actively shape what we expect and what we choose. I like that idea of imagination, using that as a tool in this idea of world building, this idea of a landscape architect can save us, because they are imagining, right? They are imagining new buildings and new ways for us to be intergenerational.
They're imagining, and they have a visionary seeing through the rubble to what underlies it in terms of the natural environment and the ecology, the cultural history of a site and so forth. And therefore, through a process of removal, they're also allowing to emerge the foundation on which all worlds are built. So, yeah, I hear you.
The idea of building a rejuvenated mythology, you know, using our imagination, our histories, this idea that we can begin to imagine a new world by blending a history with our own experience and practice the process of learning and internalizing, of practicing what matters to us in the process of aging. I think in the process, it offers those who come next, me, the next generation, an invitation into the rejuvenated process of aging. And that's really exciting, I think.
Yeah. Well said. Adrian Korn, it's been a pleasure to have you on Entitled Opinions. I want to remind our listeners we've been speaking with Dr. Adrian Korn from Nashville, Tennessee, and we're looking forward to that book on aging that you're working on.
Thanks, Harrison.
So thanks again for coming on. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Thanks for listening.
Yesterday, a child came out to wonder. Caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful when the sky was full of thunder, and tearful at the falling of a star. And the seasons, they go round and round, and the pains of ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came, and go round and round and round in the circle. Then the child moved 10 times round the seasons, skated over 10 clear frozen streams. Words like, when you're older, must appease him, and promises of someday make his dream. The seasons, they go round and round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. we can't return, we can only look